So today I'm speaking about the ministry of meditation, which may sound peculiar, but I'd like to start with a poem about meditation that I often come back to and have contemplated at various points in my life. It's by an author named Kabir. Kabir was a medieval saint in India during the time of Muslim occupation. And he was a unique spiritual master because he was very much in tune with the conflicting religions at the time. He was very much knowledgeable of Sufi mysticism. And of course, he had his background in Hindu mysticism. And he was a bridge for people, and he brought peace to communities around him. He was a weaver by trade, but in his spare time, he wrote about his experiences in meditation. And this poem is really beautiful. I'll share it with you. I talk to my inner lover, and I say, "Why such rush?" We sense that there is some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and the ants, perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark alone. Now you are tangled up in others and have forgotten what you once knew. And that's why everything you do has some weird failure in it. That last line always gave me chills because it seemed to be true about my life, that I could be successful at things, music, art, work, but there's always a sense that you're not fulfilled, that there's something you're searching for. There's some home, not the physical home, that you long to get back to. There's always a longing in us. I realized what he was talking about there, that every time I try to be truly satisfied in some external pursuit, it's always incomplete. The message I want to share with you is just one of assurance that meditation is inevitable. And I'll talk about what I mean by that in a second. But I read this other quote recently that said, "A musician can easily become a meditator. From music, move toward mystic." That is the one creative activity that I've engaged with my entire life. And I contemplated its meaning, and I thought that music is a really good metaphor for life and for the meditative experience, because music is to silence what work is to meditation. A musician is always working with silence, working from silence. Silence is the musician's canvas, and the musician feels as though, "I could attempt to make this canvas beautiful." And then you begin and you return to the silence, which is a metaphor for life, which is what Kabir is saying. We come from stillness and unity, and we end up in that stillness. And that's what I mean by meditation is inevitable, as silence is inevitable and stillness is inevitable. It's like we've been flying in a plane, and because we've been in the air so long, we begin to think that our seat is the ground. It's not the real ground, though. There's something more fundamental. And we can only fly for so long. We are destined to return to our source. Even when you think of the grandest scales of existence, the life of the universe in its 13 billion years, if it began as a singularity that exploded at the Big Bang and ends with the big chill. Scientists also hypothesize that all of the thermal energy, according to the laws of thermodynamics, will burn out. Stars will all burn out. And that will spell the end of all activity, because you need the energy for motion. When there's no more activity in the big freeze, there's no more time. To have time, you have to have movement. So that would mean that the universe goes from oneness to oneness, and in between, everything is in flight, in motion. Then it would stand to reason that stillness and unity is the truth or the reality of what we are. The parts and the drama that we participate in, that we play in, is our unique purpose, but it's not the destination. So when I was a young boy, I had this experience in the forest where I sat down and I started to contemplate what life would be like if this didn't exist, and then this didn't exist, and I subsequently moved closer and closer to my own being. And I don't know what prompted that thought experiment, but it led to a deep meditation that I had never experienced before that I knew of. So I began by questioning, what would life be like if the stars burned out and then the planets had nothing to orbit? And then if there were no more planets, and if there was no more space, and then if there was no more thought and no more mind, and then I just rested in that stillness and that emptiness. And after my thoughts resumed and I felt myself to be a boy again, I didn't know what to do with that experience. So that prompted a lifelong search till now to understand what meditation is and how we ought to integrate that into our experiences as human beings. I didn't even know the word meditation, but that's what I was searching to understand. And it wasn't until I was in college that I really got introduced to the word. I had thought that that word meant to focus on something. So when you meditate on a book, you're thinking about the meaning of the book. You're meditating on your future. Let me meditate on this for a while. So that just sounds like, let me think about something. I went on a retreat with a shaman in the wilderness of Maryland. And at this retreat, there was a Catholic nun. And she started talking to me between some of our training sessions and our workshops. I was just there as a seeker. And I asked what she was doing there, you know, being a clergy of the church. It was kind of odd. And she said, yeah, if people knew I was here, I would probably be in hot water. And she asked me, do you meditate? And I said, well, you know, I like to think about things deeply. She's like, no, that's not what meditation is. And she started to explain it to me. Then I was looking for a teacher. And I realized after finding a good teacher, so I went to people in yoga, people in philosophy, people in Reiki. And what didn't suit me was visualization and imagination and concentration, because none of that seemed to be based on what was true about my nature, about what my previous experience was. But since then, I've learned that what we call meditation, when people say, what kind of meditation do you practice? We're really talking about what kind of techniques do you practice to try to meditate? So what I've finally understood is that meditation is a state. It's like sleep. And that's why I say it's inevitable, because you're destined to sleep. You don't have to really teach somebody how to sleep. And yet we work really hard at it sometimes. And sometimes people have insomnia. More people have insomnia due to the artificial life. Since the advent of machines, we've also developed sleep techniques that probably would have sounded silly to our predecessors. So asking what kind of meditation do you practice on some level is like asking what kind of sleep do you practice. It sounds silly, but what we might be interested in is what kind of sleep techniques work for you. Does having tea at night help you? Does a certain pillow help you? Does a certain kind of music or a certain candle or a certain incense work? And what works for one person to get good sleep may not work for another. But that's what we mean, I believe, when we talk about meditation techniques. Because ultimately, sleep is sleep. There are a couple levels of sleep, though. There is dreaming, and then there's deep sleep or delta sleep. And the delta sleep is like meditation. Even dreaming is not exactly what I mean. Now, if you think about this for a moment, this analogy of sleep, when a person is only sleeping here and there intermittently, napping, they could sleep for hours a night or a day in 24 hours, but never have deep sleep. And if no one else ever had deep sleep, and the convention was intermittent napping for productivity, let's say, then it would sound strange to tell somebody about the depth of sleep, about delta sleep. That's what would make somebody a mystic. somebody saying, no, there's something deeper, something more fundamental in your rest. If you looked at that person who had the delta sleep, you would notice something different about their aura because they would be so much more refreshed. They would have an energy about them. So then becoming curious, people might ask, all right, well, what should I do to get delta sleep? And she might say, do less, which is a paradox, right? And what that means is if you keep coming back to activity, you won't relax all the way into the nature of sleep. So what I've understood about this and how it parallels to meditation is sleep has two states and wakefulness has two states. When we're dreaming while we're asleep, that's one. When we're asleep without the dream, that's two. That's the deepest. There's dreamless asleep, dreaming asleep when we're in the dream state. When we are awake, we're also dreaming. Because the majority of our time, psychologists have noted, is spent lost in thought. That means we're ruminating about the past, or planning for the future, or worried about the future, or obsessed about an object, or a person, or a place, or a thing. All of that is imagination. All of that is a dream. Now, if you think of these three states, dreamless asleep, dreaming awake, logically, it follows that there is one more, dreamless awake. That's what I think of as meditation. And I say it's inevitable because at some point, just as sleep becomes the highest priority at one point in time, nothing else will interest you. Not the pursuit of money, not relationships, not good food. Nothing else will do, and a person gives up and goes to sleep, surrenders to sleep. Similarly, you'll find that over the course of the day and over the course of your life, at some point, the burden of being somebody becomes so exhausting, and the work required to be or become that somebody fatigues you to the point where you have to just set it all down. When you can really recognize this, meditation becomes possible at any moment, anywhere. Whereas I was formally practicing morning and night for some periods of my life, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours midday, 2 hours in the evening, even 2 hours at midnight. But now I don't do that because nature demands at different times or calls at different times to rest. In the peace of your own being, because the brand that we're building as an ego is so exhausting. I think of ego as a brand. It's the character that I play. Every act is an act. Everything I do to build my personality, to express my personality, is part of the role that I play as a family member, as a counselor, as a teacher. And at some point, that wears you out. There are tools and techniques to just relax into this. And how does this relate to ministry? Well, the etymology of the word ministry has roots in Latin, the Latin word minus, which means to do less. People often aspire to attain that state, but it is not something that we acquire. It's something that we reveal. The word ministry, having its roots in minus, and having even older roots in Sanskrit, miyate, which meant to diminish, to decline, reveals the elegance of meditation. It's the substratum of what we do. And again, that's its beautiful relationship to music, that silence is always the substratum of the music. So in this sense, there may be techniques that simply help people to do less. And when we think of minister as a verb, it has roots in service. And the one who is ministering is a minister. Now, ordinarily, we think that a minister is ecclesiastic, which is a clergy of the church. But I think they found a good word that meant, you know, to serve. But when we think of the ministry of meditation, a person is basically holding space and compassionately dissuading the loved one from further activity. So I said meditation is inevitable, like sleep is inevitable, and still the parent guides their child, their baby, to sleep. Why? If sleep's inevitable? Out of love. Because you know that there are forces in the world that could distract you, that could continue the resistance to that which you need and that which you are. And then we minister to all the people in our life. The spouse ministers to the lover to stop the work. It's our time now to be still. The bell in meditation ministers to the monks to pause their work, to stop what they're doing, and to come back to stillness. One of the most famous tools in Zen tradition is the koan. And the koan is a way to guide the aspirant into meditation by giving a question that may be so absurd that it exhausts the meditator and results in the letting go of the activity and resting in the stillness. The most famous one is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And I'll just share with you a short parable about this to express its meaning. There was a Zen master named Mokurai who had a young protege named Toyo, who was only 12 years old. Toyo saw his other older disciples visit the master's meditation room and receive instructions and personal guidance and koans. And Toyo wished so deeply to meditate. But when he would ask, Mokurai would say, "Wait some time, you're too young still." And this only deepened Toyo's interest in meditation. He persisted, so the teacher finally consented. One evening, young Toyo went at the proper time to the entrance of Mokurai's meditation room. He struck the gong to announce his presence and bowed respectfully. And then Mokurai gave the instruction, "Toyo, surely you can hear the sound of two hands when they clap together, but I want you to listen to the sound of one hand clapping." So Toyo bowed and went to his own room to consider this problem and try to meditate. From his window, he could hear the music of the geishas and thought to himself, "Ah, I have it." And he proclaimed to his teacher that this is the sound. And Mokurai starts laughing, saying, no, that's not it. That's not the sound of one hand clapping. That's the sound of music and dancing. Thinking that the music might interrupt him next time, Toyo moved his space to somewhere that was more quiet and meditated again. "What can the sound of one hand be?" And then, getting quieter and quieter, he heard dripping water and thought, "Ah, I have it." And went back to his teacher and said, "It sounds like this." And he mimicked the sound of water dripping. "What is that?" Mokurai asked. "That's not the sound of one hand clapping. That's the sound of dripping water." And like this, Toyo went to quieter and quieter environments and got calmer and calmer. And he would come back with subtler and subtler sounds until Toyo gave up and said, "I hear nothing other than the soundless sound." Then the teacher said, "You have it. You are it." Any koan or any tool, any technique, its true function is to get us to stop. So I'll stop there. What we call meditation is actually a technique. Meditation is a state. I think meditation is more what we are, not what we do. In that way, it's inevitable. There's not something to attain, but there is less to do. So when we think of it as just one more task that we have to add onto our schedule, we're really thinking of it in the wrong way. Think of it as the healthy boundary with yourself at some moment to do less, to let go. Dissuade yourself from further activity. And I think the main obstacle to this is desire. There was a good quote I read recently that desire is a contract that you make with yourself to be unhappy until you get what you want. When you get what you want, you're not improved. You simply become what you were before the desire. That is why the Buddha talked about desire being the obstacle. Not that there's something inherently wrong with working or earning, but you can do those things without craving. So I'll conclude with this quote from Sufi mystic Rabia al-Basri of medieval Persia. She was known to have experienced the deepest levels of meditation and the secret of life when the highest clergy sought her out for instruction and asked, "How do you do it? How do you realize this meditation?" She elegantly replied, "You know of the how, but I know of the howless."